think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Hey, everybody, welcome in. This is episode 6 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. My name is Ben Heisler. Glad that you guys are with us once again. A full edition of the Awful Announcing Roundtable this week as I am joined by Andrew Buchholz. Hello, Andrew.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Joe Lucia is here as well. What's up, Joe?
Hello, Ben. Thanks for having me today.
Of course. And of course, the great Matt Yoder has returned after a few episode hiatus. Hello, Matt.
Thanks for having me back, Ben.
It's good to have all of you guys together. And I know it sounds a little bit familiar, but major surprise, we might start with ESPN to kick off our roundtable. But this time it's starting to intertwine a little bit. There's reports now that that they are going to be buying local Fox networks. And Joe, if you could sort of kick us off here and explain what's happening, that they're sort of diving into these local Fox Sports networks. Does this make sense for ESPN? Sort of what's the reasoning behind all of this?
Well, in these never-ending 21st century Fox sale rumors, the latest ones have Disney going back in to attempt to buy 21st century Fox. But while FS1, the main Fox Sports brand, won't be included, Fox Sports regional stations, that's like Fox Sports West, Fox Sports South, and so on and so forth, they would be included in the deal, so then they would fall under the ESPN umbrella, which I think would create a really interesting scenario, because ESPN really hasn't established a foothold in local markets, where with acquiring these local Fox stations, they really would, and it would lead to a situation, if the sale is eventually agreed to and approved and eventually authorized by the federal government, it would really lead to a situation where we're looking at like Anaheim Angels on ESPN West coming up next, as opposed to Fox Sports West and hours of infomercial today.
Well, what's interesting about this too is that a lot of times, like in here based in Kansas City where I am, you know, Fox Sports Midwest has, and Fox Sports Kansas City has the Royals games, and they also feature a lot of the Fox Sports 1 content and upcoming games on Fox Sports 1 and Fox and promos for First Things First and so on and so forth. So, Matt, would that completely change that dynamic, that all of a sudden ESPN West or all of a sudden these ESPN local stations would further benefit in promoting more ESPN-based programming?
Well, I guess it would, and it's just so funny to me. If you would have said to any sports fan that was really interested in following sports media 5, 10, 15 years ago that this would be happening, I mean, it seems like it was eons ago, but these Fox Sports regional networks, when we had the best damn sports show period, when we had Keith Olbermann and the National Sports Report, this was Fox's first real idea to compete with ESPN, and now we have the day where it looks like ESPN may be taking over those networks. I don't know, to me, the best comparison is it's almost like when Vince McMahon bought WCW. I mean, you're just waiting for the day when you see these ESPN personalities show up on these Fox Sports networks to begin the takeover. It's a hugely significant move, because you just think of how many teams locally have those games on those Fox Sports affiliates,
right,
that now can put those advertising and those programming hours towards ESPN. I think this is a much bigger deal than what a lot of people may think.
Andrew, where do you stand on this deal? And for one, I think, if especially like, at least for me, I'm thinking about it from the baseball perspective, where ESPN has struggled from a national perspective on baseball, because baseball is such a localized sport, and where a lot of these regional networks can take advantage of is a high audience content for baseball. Is that part of the reason here, or is it just collectively, let's try and get as more eyeballs on ESPN as possible, knowing that sports is one of the few things left that they can control programming and content and viewership over?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Matt. I think this is a really big deal, and it's interesting that this is just popping up, because like you say, the Fox sale talks have been going on for weeks, but most of the early reports were, oh, it'll be the parts of Fox that don't involve North American news and don't involve North American sports. This is one of the first indications that the regional sports was really on the table. I think what's really behind it is the pursuit of scale, and we're seeing that across all sorts of media at the moment. We're seeing that with things like the AT&T Time Warner deal. We're seeing that all of these media companies are trying to get bigger and bigger, and thus they're trying to find various efficiencies. They're trying to find ways that they can lay off some people who are doing the same jobs, have some people handle things across a broader network. And I think where this is really going to be important when it comes to ESPN and Fox regional networks is with the carriage disputes. We see carriage disputes regularly with regional sports networks that aren't offered on one provider for one reason or another, on Dish or on DirecTV or whatever.
No.
That's going to be a lot harder for them to pass on if those are all of a sudden now that's in talks with ESPN's other channels. And something where ESPN has really been successful in these carriage agreements has been, oh, well, you've got to take the SEC network if you want ESPN. And so they managed to get a lot of these other channels carried as a result of that. ESPN has such an advantage in the distribution agreements in the first place. And if they bring in these regional networks, it's going to be really hard for providers to say, okay, well, we're going to pass, because now they're going to be controlling so much of the sports market.
So, Joe, let me throw this one back to you, and you guys can all respond on this as well. If we've been hearing that ESPN is losing subscribers left and right, and people cutting the cord has caused all these layoffs and significant payroll decreases for ESPN, where is the money coming from? Where do we follow the trail here?
Well, you have to realize that this isn't ESPN buying Fox. This is Disney buying Fox.
Okay.
And Disney is such a giant, huge conglomerate that has so much money that, I mean, the regional sports channels, they're just a small part of this. They're not the primary focus of the deal. This is just something that's going into it. And I think it'll eventually help cut costs actually for ESPN, because I think they can maybe make some reporters redundant instead of having to send, say, Pedro Gomez to New York to cover Alex Rodriguez. They can just go to a Yes Network reporter that's already there and cover them that way. And it would just have them have these hyper-local people that are already there covering the teams. They could just rely on them for a lot of their coverage, and they might be able to rely on them for some online coverage, and they might be able to cut some costs there as well. So I think in the long run, while this is going to cost a decent bit of money up front, I think when all is said and done, it could end up with them actually saving some money or streamlining things a little bit more.
Matt, is this also sort of how ESPN was thinking initially in the processes of creating local content? I think ESPN Chicago was the first to launch, and then ESPN Dallas started to merge, and you had the NFL Nation and reporters from all the different teams in the NFL. Is this just sort of a further reflection on, let's localize but sort of do it on our own terms?
Yeah, you can't help but think of the evolution there with ESPN going through so many iterations, and we saw that big push with the local affiliate sites in the big markets like Chicago, LA, New York, Dallas, and
yeah,
we saw that scale back quite a way, except for the NFL, where you basically have a reporter in every market. That's why I think what Joe said is so important here. Now ESPN doesn't have to build that infrastructure locally. They can just go into every market, slap the ESPN brand on it, and it's a done deal. So for them to be able to get to these local markets in sports like baseball with coverage like the NBA just gives them so many more resources and such a deeper, yet at the same time, wider reach, especially at a time where there's so much uncertainty about what's in ESPN's future. What is their business going to look like? This could be a pretty big deal for them. And I don't think it's just at a local level. I mean, imagine the ESPN streaming platform. Eventually, that's going to come someday, probably sooner rather than later. What if you had all of these affiliate channels and regional sites involved in that, where now fans can get access to those channels and to those games, to those rights on one platform? So I don't think we know right now what the full extent of this could be for ESPN from both a local and a national perspective. But I think as this plays out, we're going to see that it could have a pretty big impact on ESPN moving forward.
All right, last one on this from me, and Andrew, I'll have you close this out. How should Fox be feeling about these purchases from ESPN of these local Fox Sports networks? Should Fox be concerned that a lot of their content and a lot of their providers are starting to go away, or should they be happy that money is coming in?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think there's certainly advantages for a regional network and a national network to be under the same brand. I think we've seen that with NBC and with Comcast and the shift of those regional networks into NBC sports networks. So there will be some losses for Fox from not having those regional networks and from not having the Fox branding on them. Ben, you mentioned earlier about the promos for national Fox shows.
Yeah.
Well, that's likely going to go away, and you're not going to see as much of a push for FS1 programming, and it gets harder and harder for FS1 to really stand on their own. However, I think that's pretty far down the list of impacts that we're looking at here when it comes to everything else that's involved in this deal. And while I think it's really more about what this could mean for ESPN in terms of really going into the local markets, in terms of getting the control of those local sports and getting access to that local talent as people who could report for you, who can maybe be called up to the big network here and there where you need them. And I think the carriage rights are something to keep in mind, too, that brings in a lot of extra leverage for them. So from those perspectives, it's very helpful to ESPN. Fox will be losing out some from that, and it certainly does raise a few more questions about the future of FS1.
All right, let's
follow up on that quick. Fox kind of tried to do this model where they would reach out a little bit to the local networks when they had America's pregame. They would have like pregame hits from all across the country, from like Cavs games in Cleveland and Hornets games and various like baseball games. But they never really did much of anything with that once they got rid of America's pregame. They just kind of had this like pool of talent at the local level that they didn't take advantage of. Now it's just kind of creating like kind of boring content for FoxSports.com, and that's really about it when they could have done so much more with it over the years.
And now that content will exist in video form and we'll go on from here. I want to talk about one other component to ESPN, and John Skipper constantly has remained in the news. We talked about him a couple weeks ago, now that the new deal for Mike Greenberg's show is coming out, as well as the debut of Golic and Wingo from last week. All indications are that went relatively smoothly. But John Skipper is calling everybody at ESPN basically into Bristol. They're all having a meeting. And we've been critical of John Skipper on this show for basically trying to please everybody when we're living in a reality that's not really possible. So I guess if you're John Skipper, Joe, and I'll start this off with you, what are you saying to your employees at this point to say, how do we ensure that the 2018 is not a year of a lot of embarrassing things that were to surface out of ESPN? What is he saying to his troops at this point?
I really think this social media meeting, or whatever they're calling it, that they're going to have in the next week or so, I think it has all of the makings of being a complete disaster if Skipper says the wrong things or kind of tries to like group people separately, like grouping some reporters differently from others and different from anchors. And if he tries to just kind of put people into different tiers, I think there could be a wide scale revolt, and we could, even though he just got this contract extension, I think we could see major changes if this meeting kind of explodes the way I expect it to. And he really has to just kind of be careful to not step on any toes and not rub people the wrong way, because I know a lot of people at ESPN really are kind of on edge right now. And if Skipper decides to kind of divide the new newsbreakers, up from the anchors, up from just kind of like the lower level commentators, we could be in a situation where absolutely nobody is happy at the end of this.
That's a great point. I think a lot of it'll become who ends up getting the final say. You think it's easy, Matt, to say, well, it's Skipper, he's the president of the network, but when you have high profile talent at a place like ESPN, that may not always be the case. You think about like NBA teams. Like, is it going to be the general manager, LeBron James, that ends up winning out? But the majority of the time, it's going to be LeBron, and not to the GM or not Dan Gilbert or whatever it may be. So how do you anticipate this all going?
Well, here's the reality of this situation. John Skipper, and granted, we've seen ESPN go through a number of rounds of layoffs, but how many hundreds and hundreds of employees does he still have at ESPN? How many dozens and dozens of employees does he have that have over 5-6-figure followers on Twitter? You're telling me that after this meeting in Bristol, every single one of them is going to completely toe the company line where we don't see another controversy happen in 2018? I think that's just totally unrealistic and not within the realm of possibility at all. So I don't know. Maybe I just see this as a fait accompli almost, and I see it as trying to shuffle the deck chairs almost and throw darts at the wall, whatever metaphor you want to use. I see that he's just fighting a losing battle here, because no matter what policies are in place, no matter how many all-company meetings you have, there's no way to guarantee that you're going to have every single ESPN employee adhere to whatever guidelines you put in place, because we've seen in the past that it's a selective process of who actually has to follow those rules and who doesn't. And so I think no matter what happens at this meeting, no matter what's put on paper, send in an email, company memo, you have it, there's going to be another controversy involving ESPN in 2018 with social media, with someone speaking their mind. And it's, to me, it's just a matter of, can ESPN do some damage control a bit better than what we saw in 2017?
Andrew, if you're writing the headline over at awfulannouncing.com and you're writing your opening sentence, what do you anticipate it being after this meeting is complete and some of the details and the leaks start to come out?
Yeah, I mean, I think any headline is probably going to revolve around the details that do come out. And I do think we're going to get a lot of details from this meeting, because you've got such a huge group of people there and such an unwieldy group of people there. This is not all people from the same division, from the same area. These are a wide variety of people with, as Joe and Matt mentioned, a wide variety of different levels of social media presence. They're not operating on the same level. They're not doing the same things. And I think bringing them all in for this kind of speech really is not going to really solve anything. And I think the issue that you really see there is something that speaks to the structure of ESPN. ESPN is a giant company, and few people really realize this, because they'll comment on ESPN based on one particular aspect of it. Oh, I don't like the six, so that ESPN is failing for me. I don't like the new sports center, ESPN is failing for me. But if you look at who actually works there and who's actually going to be brought into this meeting, it's so much more than any of those particular shows. And I think where ESPN historically has been effective is with sort of a decentralized structure, where they have certain people at the top, they have people who report to them, and then they let each of those people sort of run their own area of it. And when there's a controversy, it's addressed with the particular manager, maybe the executive above them. They've got about 20 or more vice presidents of one thing or another, right? So it's not like it's one person overseeing all of this. And I think that that's really going to be the problem with this meeting, is that it's something that really feels like a company that isn't ESPN. It feels like something that like a local tech startup would do, or something that a local, like, let's get everybody on board company would do. But I don't think you can really do that at the scale of ESPN. And especially when you're bringing these people in from all over the country, paying a whole lot of money to do that, and doing it very publicly and very noisily right after you've just laid a whole bunch of people off. I don't think that's a great look.
I mean, it's almost like Michael Scott at the Duncan Mifflin Scranton branch calling everyone into the boardroom for a meeting. That's what this thing sounds and looks like. I don't know if that applies to a multi-billion dollar company like ESPN.
Just as long as John Skipper doesn't walk out of that meeting going, I declare bankruptcy! Might be a non-timely joke on that part. I will think that the interesting component of this is that when the details start to come out, if there's a whole meeting in place on social media policy, ironically enough, it will be leaked from somebody at ESPN, but I would imagine that the details of the meeting are not going to come out from ESPN employees. So the question will be, well, who gets the details and where do they get the details from? Eventually, we'll be able to follow that paper trail. Any final words on this upcoming meeting for ESPN from anybody?
Man, it'll be interesting to see the over-under and what happens first, whether the details leak or whether someone breaks those social media guidelines first. To me, that's the most interesting part.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that, like, by 7 o'clock that night, people are going to go back to tweeting like nothing ever happened at this meeting. It's going to literally do nothing.
I kind of like Matt's idea as a possible awful announcing post, over-unders from the... from the upcoming ESPN meeting. I think that could be really interesting.
Just as long as we don't need a company-wide meeting once all this is done.
I consider this our company-wide meeting, frankly. Like, we're pretty much all together. We can talk amongst ourselves, but your point is well received. Let's move on to college football. The regular season has come to a conclusion. We have about 1,000 bowl games on the way, which we can get into maybe in the next episode or so, but I kind of want to go quickly through this. Now that the season is over, and Maddie, I'll start with you on this. What stood out to you from the college football season? What was something that maybe worked or didn't work? If you sort of had your one major takeaway from college football coverage and the presentation of the games, what would it be?
Are you saying this is where I don't get to give my anti-Alabama rant for the college football playoff?
I didn't know it was a tradition unlike any other, but you're more than welcome to dive in.
Well, you know, Alabama gets a bye, and it's just the other 124 teams that are fighting for the other three spots. No, I think maybe it's so fresh in my mind. Maybe it's because I am here in Central Ohio where this is a very sore subject. But to me, it's not even really about Ohio State versus Alabama. I mean, those resumes are so flawed with those two teams. I don't think there was necessarily a right and a wrong choice. But to me, the tribalism in those debates, especially in the hours leading up to it, where you had basically all of the Fox guys after the Big Ten championship game saying Ohio State should be in, there's no doubt. And you had all of the ESPN/SEC, Paul Feinbaum, Booger McFarland, you know, basically championing Alabama. I tweeted this. I mean, it's basically like you're watching Fox News and MSNBC, and you're just waiting. Who's the one Fox guy going to be? Who's the Shepard Smith that's going to dare criticize Donald Trump here and actually break out a line? I mean, to sit down and to see Booger McFarland trying to make the case for why Mercer is a feather in the cap of Alabama. To me, that's my takeaway of the insanity of this playoff and this college football media environment that we're in.
What about you, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a funny point. We wrote about that the other day with Ryan Rosilio from ESPN talking about how everyone else is biased and you should only trust me because I went to a school that didn't have football. And his argument was pretty absurd and over the top, but it is sort of funny seeing how some people argue based on where they went or what rights their network has. And I want to build that into something larger. I think the largest takeaway for me from this college football season was how many issues there are with Fox's coverage, and not necessarily with anything that they do on the broadcast, but with where their broadcast winds up. We saw a whole bunch of games bumped to FS2, bumped to Fox Business Channel, starting on Fox Business Channel. And none of that, I mean, I think what that really shows, it's not necessarily problems with executives at Fox. It's just that Fox doesn't have the channel tonnage that ESPN does. Whenever there's weird things happen in college football, whether it's weather delays, whether it's some other sort of delay or whatever, games don't start and end when they're supposed to a lot of the time. But with ESPN, that's never really a problem. They just run a little ticker on the screen. Oh, this game is starting over on ESPN. It's starting over on ESPN News. And those channels have wide enough penetration that that isn't really a problem. Whenever it happens to Fox, it's a giant crisis because nowhere near as many people have FS2 or have Fox Business. And then they also do this to themselves a bit when they wind up with scheduling different truck races and so on that are going to cut into it. But I think it really shows the huge advantage ESPN has as a college football broadcaster is that they've got just this incredible tonnage of channels that there's always a place for them to put games.
Doesn't NBC also, though, just to follow up, doesn't NBC occasionally run into those problems as well during hockey season and Stanley Cup playoff season?
Yeah. I mean, you certainly see that with hockey a little bit. I mean, it's useful for NBC that they at least it's weird to see games on MSNBC or whatever, but at least it has enough penetration that's in most cable packages. The problem is really when you get down to stuff like FS2 that just isn't widely carried. But yeah, it's certainly not something that's exclusive to Fox. So you certainly do see it with other cable networks too. I just thought that was particularly glaring this college football season with Fox and with some of the games they missed.
I think one easy way that you can solve that just to motivate the companies to sort of get their act together is that if they're not able to start the game on time on the scheduled broadcast, you have to have people that are on that network comment the game. So, for example, you know, I was about to say Sterling Shepard. What's the name of the Fox guy? Shepard Smith?
Mm-hmm.
So Shepard Smith has to call a college football game if they can't get their act together. Or Rachel Maddow's got to call a hockey game. And then all of a sudden, then everybody's going to start to get their act together. That's a terrible idea, but I'll move on to Joe for what you saw out of college football.
Well, this was my first football season on the West Coast. So I've been dealing with a lot more like Pac-12 fans and watching more Pac-12 games. And my main takeaway was, man, Pac-12 network is really still a disgrace all these years later. We'll try to go out to watch a game, but we need to make sure the bar or restaurant has Pac-12 network, and then it doesn't have Pac-12 network, so we have to find another place, and then that place is crowded because it's the only place in the general area that has Pac-12 network, and the production is nothing to write home about. The six different sub feeds or whatever it is just downright bizarre. There's no real rhyme or reason to which games are on the channel. Like, they'll have a random UCLA game on, but Arizona is on FS1 or whatever, which, okay, whatever, sure. It's just a stark difference from the Big Ten Network, which, I mean, started this whole conference network thing all these years ago. And it's just such a stark difference that they really don't know what they're doing still all these years later. It's such a mess. And I can only imagine what it's like if you're not in a Pac-12 market. Like, if you're in, Texas or Florida or Minnesota and you're a fan of one of these teams and want to watch your game, it must be that much worse and that much more complicated. And they really made a big mistake not partnering with either Fox or ESPN or NBC just to kind of get a little more guidance and know what they were doing, because it's really appalling how bad this is still all these years later.
What about from the broadcast side? Did anything stand out with you guys about Brett Nessler having his first year at CBS? There was no Brett Musburger or Vern Lundquist calling games. Mike Tirico was on the Notre Dame call. You had Maria Taylor replace Sam Ponder in the ABC game of the night. Andrew, I'll start with you on this one. From the broadcast perspective, was there anything in particular that stood out?
Yeah, I was actually quite positively impressed with Brad Nessler. I think it was he had big shoes to fill with Vern Lundquist on the SEC on CBS. Vern was somebody who so many fans loved for so long. And I don't think Brad Nessler he doesn't have the fan following, but I think he did as well as you could do following in those kinds of shoes. He seems to fit in with Gary Danielson quite well. I think in some ways he's maybe even figured out how to get a little bit more out of Gary on some particular plays and some particular analysis. And maybe some of that's just a fresh perspective as compared to a guy like Lundquist who had worked with him for so long. But I think Nessler did a really good job. And for the most of the SEC on CBS, broadcast I watched, the announcing was never really anything to complain about other than Gary still saying some problematic things here and there. But I think that move went about as well as you could have hoped for a CBS.
What about for you, Joe?
I was kind of shocked when I was watching the Big Ten championship game that, man, Gus Johnson's really gotten, he's really kind of lost his fastball in recent years. I mean, he gets excited over smaller plays to the point where he's missing, like, the fact that the ball was dropped and it wasn't a catch, or someone stepped out of bounds, or there was a flag. It seems like he's trying to kind of turn up the Gus level to 12 on every other play, and it's really just kind of taking away from the overall broadcast. I know for years we've been huge fans of his, but from what I heard of him this season, it just kind of seemed like he was trying to be a little too excitable and was taking away from the end products.
Maddie? Maybe we should send Gus Johnson back to calling soccer.
No. Just in time for Russia 2018. No. Just in the nick of time.
I mean, they might consider it. I mean, they need eyeballs in any way, shape, or form with the U.S. not playing.
You know, that is it. That is the marketing ploy. We don't have the USMNT. But hey, Gus Johnson is back, so you better tune in.
And maybe the tagline is, who says the U.S. isn't in the World Cup?
Oh, man, imagine the traffic we would get in June.
can we start a campaign for it? We can start a hashtag for it.
One thing that we're going to need to do is to get casual fans interested in soccer. That was the whole point of Gus Johnson in the first place.
Right.
So why the heck not?
Yeah, at this point, you got nothing to lose.
I think so.
What about for you, Matt, from the broadcast side on college football this season?
Well, we're talking about lead announcers. I actually caught myself saying this to a friend the other day during the championship weekend. To me, it's interesting now. A few years down the road, I feel like Chris Fowler has really grown into that number one play-by-play spot at ESPN. The partnership with Kirk Herbstreit, I think early on, it kind of sounded like he was a studio guy trying to sound like a play-by-play guy in college football. Now, he was, of course, one of the most talented broadcasters that we have working today. You look at his work on College Game Day, on tennis, on what have you, but such big shoes to fill with Brent Musburger, and it just didn't seem comfortable there that first year or so. But to me, he's really found his groove, especially working with Kirk Herbstreit. And now you kind of look forward, at least I do, to those games that they call together. So for me, it's just the growing comfort in how Chris Fowler has taken hold of that number one play-by-play spot at ESPN.
A lot of good stuff there from college football. But the final one for us today, we've talked ESPN, we've talked Fox. Let's get into Sports Illustrated a little bit. They were recently sold along with Time to Meredith, and I think a lot of people are concerned that it could be sold again. Regarding the Sports Illustrated sale, Matt, I'll start with you on this one. Any initial thoughts come to mind, and do you think this could be a process where they kind of get passed around a little bit?
Well, it's just hard to gauge any sort of future analysis and looking into the crystal ball with the print industry and Sports Illustrated, because to me, it's just so uncertain. So I don't know if this sale is a stay of execution for the magazine. I don't know if it means you'll see a transformation on the digital side. It's just hard for me to look at Sports Illustrated and see what the long-term hope or vision is, especially from the magazine perspective. So I don't know. I guess for me, I'm taking a wait and see approach as to what exactly the impact is moving forward, because you just look at so many of these legacy publications like a Sports Illustrated, you just get the feeling that they're kind of living on borrowed time, don't you? So I don't know. I guess I don't really have strong feelings one way or the other about it. I just look at the overall trend of the industry and see that Sports Illustrated is trying to make the best out of a situation where the cards and the deck kind of seem to be stacked against them.
Andrew, do you feel like that's a fair characterization of what's going on with Sports Illustrated right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think Matt's certainly right that a lot of the issues around all these titles are far bigger than Sports Illustrated and are with legacy publications and with print in general. I do think it's really, from my mind, it's very positive to hear that there might be a separate sale or a spinoff of Sports Illustrated after Meredith buys Time Inc. Because we've been writing for over a year that it doesn't look like Meredith is going to fit with SI at all. Like, Meredith is very focused on what they want. They want people. They maybe want Time. They want these publications that fit with their existing magazines focused at adult women, and Sports Illustrated really is not that. So I think it's reassuring to hear that there's a chance of a further sale or a spinoff or something, because I think that would speak what Sports Illustrated can do well. I think there's going to be value in Sports Illustrated for somebody, and the question is going to be who at this point. But there are a lot of people who are interested in sports content. There are a lot of people who still recognize the Sports Illustrated brand, and that's why they're trying to do all these other things, like launching their SI TV Amazon channel, doing SI swimsuit wear, and so on. Like, Sports Illustrated as a brand still carries some value. And I think there are going to be people interested in buying Sports Illustrated, and there will be more and better suitors for SI alone, I think, than when it's bundled with all these other Time Inc. properties that Meredith wants.
So, Joe, based on that perspective, if not Meredith for Sports Illustrated, then who?
I mean, I really have no idea. It could be some startup, some other tech company. I mean, I could even see, this sounds kind of crazy, I could see something like ESPN buying it and folding it into like ESPN the magazine, which really hasn't gotten off the ground 15 years running or however long it is, kind of Sports Illustrated presented by ESPN or something like that. Because right now, the SI really just has the brand going for it. And in 20 years, I'm not sure if that brand is going to be as strong as it is today. I really doubt it is. I think a lot of younger kids these days, they kind of look at SI in the same way a lot of us look at Sporting News, a brand that we kind of grew up with, but is kind of like outdated and really kind of falling behind when you look at some other outlets like, Bleacher Report, which is kind of cutting edge of doing a lot of things and becoming really popular and more traffic, that kind of thing. I think SI really just needs to, I think it needs to kind of decide what it is, because it still has its finger in a lot of pots right now. And I think they're trying to do too much. I don't know if the magazine should be the focus going forward, if they should focus on this OTT channel, or if they should focus on the website. They have a lot of big decisions.
Well, no doubt. We'll see whether or not it ultimately gets sold again, or whether or not Meredith decides to hang on. Either way, it's an iconic brand. I'll be curious to see how it ultimately goes down. That was our edition of the Roundtable for Episode 6 of the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by our good friends over at Clip It. Andrew Buchholz, Matt Yoder, Joe Lucia, appreciate your guys' time as always. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week, hopefully with a very fun feature interview. This is Ben Heisler. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast.